Associate Chief Justice Jerry presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Chief Justice Sada is out of the jurisdiction on court business, and so as Associate Chief Justice, I will preside today, and she will listen to the arguments, and then we'll conference with us on this case and the other cases today. Our first case today is case number 56801, Nevada Public Employees Retirement Board versus Smith. Mr. Wicker, on behalf of the board.
Thank you, Mr. Associate Chief Justice, Justices. I'm Chris Wicker of Woodburn & Wedge, appearing on behalf of the Public Employees Retirement Board and its members. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for my rebuttal, if I could, please.
Certainly.
When I was looking at this case in preparation for oral argument, an old saying struck me that is very applicable to this case. You know that a lot of times old sayings carry a lot of truth in them, and that's why they keep getting repeated over and over. The one that struck me as to this case is the saying that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. You may wonder, what applicability does that have to this case? The record is undisputed that Judge Smith was led to the water by PERS numerous times. He attended a PERS orientation for judges. He met with PERS counselors. He obtained benefit estimate calculations. He was given access to the website. He was given the information telephone number. He was given the pre-retirement guide twice. He was given the service application instructions twice. He was given the service retirement application twice. And he was even advised by the human resources manager of Clark County to make January 2nd his retirement date, January 2nd of 2009 his retirement date, which he did not. All these sources had important information, but Judge Smith did not drink from the water offered by PERS. The only thing that he did was to ask counselors for benefit calculations. He was only interested in the different scenarios and how much money he would get if he handled his retirement in different ways. He did not ask questions except about benefits. He did not go to the website or call the PERS helpline with questions. He did not read the pre-retirement guide. He didn't read the application instructions. He didn't even read the service retirement application that he signed. He decided on his own volition to set January 4th, 2009 as his own date of termination and retirement as a justice of the peace. All of the important information regarding how he was going to obtain his goals in this retirement were assumed by Judge Smith without actually finding out what the law was or what PERS said about it.
Now, Mr. Wicker, I'm reading the decision from Judge Puccinelli, and it says between January 1, 2009, January 4, 2009, Judge Smith was not drawing a paycheck for his service as Justice of the Peace. And my understanding from the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, he resigned as a Justice of the Peace term. So wouldn't there have been a break in service between the time he was a Justice of the Peace until he became a district judge on January 5th?
No, there wasn't, Your Honor, and I can address that situation very, very directly. Judge Smith, the issue was the court found that his legal date of termination was December 31st, and he based that on two things. One, that there was a paycheck of December 19th. The record is clear that Judge Smith was paid an annual salary, and the second decision, the second basis of the court's decision was that the human resources manager in her deposition speculated that maybe Judge Smith wasn't on the payroll from January 1st to January 4th. However, the information that PERS had and that PERS had to rely on was this. First of all, Judge Smith wrote a letter to the Clark County Commission, to Roy Reed and the Commission, stating that he was resigning and retiring effective as of January 4th, 2009. That letter was provided to PERS before it reviewed his case. There's a Clark County SAP action form dated December 17th, 2008, in which it states, Judge Smith's effective date of separation was January 4th, 2009. There's a termination from PERS form, which is required of all employers to submit to PERS when somebody leaves service of a public employer. The termination form filled out by Clark County, dated December 23rd, 2008, said the termination effective date was January 4th, 2009. A copy of that same termination, termination from PERS form, came to PERS from the comptroller's office, said that his termination date was January 4th, 2009. The service retirement application, filled out in handwriting by Judge Smith, stated that his last day of employment was January 4th, 2009.
So was he paid through January 4th, or in your opinion, does that make any difference at all?
It doesn't make any difference at all. I think an argument can be made that he was paid through that date because when he took office on January 3rd in 1995, which is in the record, he received a paycheck for the period of mid-December to January 1st, and this is in the information from Kathleen Lambermont. But I don't think it matters, and it doesn't matter because in order to be eligible to retire, you have to have a break in service. In order to have a break in service, you have to consider both the end of creditable service, which is what Judge Puccinelli was talking about, and you have to consider the last day of employment. The record is just overwhelming that the last day of employment was January 4th, 2009. Now, PERS gets all this information from Clark County, his employer. He gets a handwritten signed statement from Judge Smith that his last day of employment is January 4th, 2009. What on earth is PERS supposed to do? The evidence is completely underwhelming that his last day of employment was December 31st, 2008, there's no documentation of that whatsoever.
Now, in the briefs, it indicated that PERS' concern was primarily that with no break in service, if you were to conclude otherwise, that there was a break in service and find his date was December 31st, there could be ramifications with the status of the program as a whole, because there were IRS consequences.
You have to keep in mind, and I think the Judge Puccinelli was confused on this point. There's two completely independent reasons why PERS had to deny his retirement. And I provided to you a copy of a statute I think we're going to be talking about today, which is NRS 286-541. And in that statute provides the relevant law that we have to deal with. But the first independent basis is that you have to have a break in service between the end of your employment and the start of a new employment. And that break, if you're going to retire, you have to retire in that break in service, because under 286-541-2, it requires, sets forth four conditions. And the later of these four conditions is the date that somebody becomes eligible to retire. Now, the other independent grounds is that you cannot retire from PERS when you're already employed in a PERS-eligible position. Now, if you look at 286-541, it is undisputed that Judge Smith filed his application with PERS on January 8th, 2009. Judge Smith took office as a justice of the peace, as a district judge, on January 5th, 2009, per the Nevada Constitution. So if you look at 286-541-2, if you look at A, the day immediately following applicant's last day of employment, well, in this case, that would have been January 5th. B, the day the completed application form is filed with the system. Well, that's later. That's January 8th, 2009. The day following the applicant's last day of creditable service. Well, on January 8th, 2009, he was receiving creditable service. And so pursuant to 286-541, because he started his job as a district judge without a break in service, first independent basis, and he had not retired from PERS when he started his job as a district judge. Now, under Nevada law, Judge Smith must wait till he finishes his employment as a district judge before he can retire. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
No, I was looking more specifically. You'd made the arguments that there were tax consequences.
Well, yes.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, Your Honor. In order for PERS to be a qualified plan, we're talking about the whole PERS plan that covers all the thousands of retired persons and I presume thousands of currently employed persons. Under IRS regulations, you cannot have an in-service distribution. What that means is that somebody can't retire and receive benefits while they're in service, while they're employed in a PERS eligible job. And so if PERS were to ignore the law and say, okay, even though you're employed in a PERS job, you can still retire, that's an in-service distribution. And, you know, I would be speculating as to what the IRS would do with that or if they'd even find out.
Well, you intimated in the briefs it would cause some great jeopardy to the plan as a whole.
Well, it would. It would. If PERS found out, I mean, if IRS found out about it and decided to take action on it, yes, it would, because it's a prohibited in-service distribution.
But, Mr. Wicker, again, in Judge Puccinelli's order under NRS 286.190 subsection 4, PERS has authority to correct inequities here. It gives it so it seems to me this thing was known certainly the first week of January. There could have been a nunk-pro-tunk consideration of this if there was a misunderstanding or whatever. I mean, from what I understand from the record, the PERS knew that Judge Smith wanted to retire, pay the penalty. So PERS might actually save money in the long run because of the 4% penalty, you know, since he wasn't eligible to fully retire and start a brand new program with JRS. If that's what he wanted to do, and they knew it, and they had the power to correct that inequity, you know, like that or misunderstanding, what's wrong with that? I mean, Judge Puccinelli felt that they, you know, they could have done that.
Well, Your Honor, they don't have that kind of power to correct inequity. What we're talking about here is you would be asking PERS to violate Nevada law by granting him his retirement while he's in service and without a break in service.
Mr. Wicker, yes. I'm sorry. I wanted you to complete your answer for Justice Gibbons, and then I have a question.
Go ahead.
Complete your answer.
What that means is that statute that you referred to has been used to correct inequities in the cases where somebody has been misled by inaccurate PERS information or other extenuating circumstances, but has never been interpreted to this day anyway, as to allow PERS to actually violate an express Nevada statute to grant some kind of equity. And so if this court were to say, PERS, you know, you have to consider violating express statutes in order to grant equity, then how is PERS ever going to administer this system if somebody else does what Judge Smith does, which is ignore all the procedures for getting accomplishing his retirement, and you're asking PERS to ignore the law and grant this special treatment? You know, where does that stop, and how does PERS administer the system under that definition of correcting an inequity?
Thank
Mr.
you.
Wicker, NRS 286.193A is a part of the overall PERS plan to which the IRS is very familiar. And that statute seems to me to read broader than you're suggesting. It says that PERS may, it's discretionary, adjust the service or correct the records, allowance, or benefits of any member, retired employee, or beneficiary after an error or inequity has been determined. Now, it looks to me that as though the PERS board's approach to equity has been limited, as you suggested. But the statute, as I read it, is not so limited. Should this matter be remanded for the PERS board to reevaluate the equitable issues, if any, that are articulated by Smith?
I think if you read the PERS board's findings and conclusions, I think they did evaluate the equitable considerations that they believed fell within that statute. What Judge Smith is asking this court to do is not to correct the record, not to adjust his service. What they're asking this court to do is say, you can ignore the law and not have your break in service. You can also file your retirement application while you are currently employed with a PERS employer, and as expressly prohibited by the law, you can now retire anyway.
Let me add one part to my question. I don't read the statute as limiting PERS authority to make an equitable adjustment to only those circumstances in which it is alleged that there was a misrepresentation by PERS of information about the program. Would you agree with me about that?
I think yes. I mean, I think the statute says that, Your Honor, but I think there's a complete difference in kind between fixing somebody's amount of the retirement or something along those lines, like happened in the Byrne case, as compared to this situation where you're asking the PERS to say, violate NRS 286-541 and grant an in-service distribution. And I think there's a very distinct difference between the kind of equity that has been considered in the past in this case, where you would be asking PERS to violate the statute. Now, if
Wait. Nobody's asking PERS to violate the statute, and my question does not suggest that for a moment. I'm asking you as counsel for PERS whether they, in assessing equity requests from members, I'm asking to, for purposes of interpreting this statute, it seems as though this statute is broader than the way it's been applied by the PERS board. Is that correct, or do you disagree?
It may be broader than what the PERS board has applied in the past.
Does not this statute permit the board to look at factual claims by members and make assessments as to whether there have been mistakes and thus inequities created in determining such things as breaks in service?
I think what you stated is correct, Mr. Justice, but I think that they did assess whether there was a break in service.
I understand that argument. I'm trying to focus on the interpretation of the statute. And my concern is whether the PERS board's approach is too limited. That is, does the board assume that this statute only applies in circumstances in which a member, or it is alleged that PERS or its staff misrepresented a fact or a benefit calculation?
That plus when it's shown that the PERS has made a mistake in calculating the service record or the benefits due somebody. But as counsel for PERS, I would say that, you know, grant somebody an in-service distribution or as Judge Smith is asking in this case, is expressly prohibited by Nevada law, and therefore
could, for example, the board have exercised its discretion and found a break in service under this hypothetical. Smith terminates as of December 31st. He's not paid from December 31st to January 5th, and the record shows that. This is a hypothetical. I'm not assuming these facts. And then the county, in error, reports that his last day of employment is January 4th. And he comes to the board and says, wait, my last day of employment was December 31st. There was a break in service. Could the PERS board rely on this statute in redetermining his break in service?
I think that, yes, they could evaluate whether a break in service was accurately determined. But in this case, Your Honor, that's not enough because the other completely independent basis to deny his retirement is that he did not file his retirement application.
Well, that's my next question. And that is, it seems as though the provisions in 286.541.2 have to be read in concert with 286.193A. And so what you're suggesting is notwithstanding anything in 286.193A, they can't correct or adjust any of the dates that are reflected from 2A, 541.2A.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, because those dates are fixed by statute. And let's assume...
So if the member submits it too late, there's nothing for PERS board to fix or correct. There's no inequity that can be fixed.
Well, you have to understand, in this case is a special circumstance because Judge Smith was attempting to double dip in both PERS and JRS, which, had he done it right, is permitted. But in most cases, the delay in filing the application is not going to matter because they're not going to take another public job. Now, the information that Judge Smith was provided that he didn't read told him expressly that if you're going to take another public job after retiring from a prior public job, you need to consult with PERS and get all the details fixed out. And it tells him expressly, file your application for retirement prior to the date you want to retire. And in this case, when he filed it on January 8th, PERS cannot, it's received in the office on January 8th. PERS cannot pretend that it was received in the office on January 4th or January 5th. They just don't do that. And so when it was and as you know, when somebody is employed, is in a PERS job, and they are elected in a JRS-eligible job, they're in PERS, and they're automatically rolled into, they're automatically rolled into PERS when they take the district judge job, until later on if they file the proper paperwork to withdraw from PERS and elect JRS, which the judge did in this case.
Mr. Wicker, you used a term, double dip. I think that should be clarified for the record. Judge Smith was entitled to these benefits if he had correctly presented the paperwork. There's nothing sinister or inappropriate about that. He earned those benefits. He was entitled to those benefits even while he was serving as a district court judge. The issue is timing. So I think a correction is appropriate about the reference to such a term.
And I didn't mean to use the term in the sense that there was something illegal going on. We have admitted all along that had Judge Smith followed the law, he could perfectly legally done what he wanted to do.
I'm concerned about that too, and that's why I made a point about the discount. Now, you understand, as you know, you got to take 4% per year discount if you retire before age 60. So if you retire at age 57, that's 12% off the top on pension. And in this particular case, I mean, I don't know the numbers, but in reading it, I suspect Judge Smith hurt himself financially by retiring from PERS. You know, like assuming he had done it, even if he had collected by taking the discount, and then just starting from scratch in the judicial retirement system. So this wasn't any long-term financial windfall to him. It actually hurt him. It's probably more of a cash flow issue, I suspect.
I think it's clear what Judge Smith wanted to do was to receive his earned retirement from PERS while he was employed as a district judge and earning a new retirement in JRS.
Right.
We don't dispute that he could perfectly legally do that. The Nevada legislature has set up the laws so that he could do that, but they also have set up laws that require certain actions be taken in order to accomplish that purpose.
I have one other question, and it's related to Justice Hardesty's question about the scope and extent of PERS's equity discretion to overlook and repair mistakes that are made, not induced by them, but may have been made by retirees. In this case, there's a third adjustment that would have to be equitably made because he elected into the JRS program. And as I read NRS 1A280 sub 6, it says a justice or judge who exercises the option granted by this section may not reestablish the service for which the liabilities were transferred. And my understanding from the record is the million-dollar liability that PERS had representing the judicial retirement benefits were transferred to JRS because Judge Smith made the election. So the equitable discretion would have to also extend to allowing him to go back and unwind that transfer, and I wanted you to comment on whether or not that reading by me is correct.
I think you're absolutely correct, Justice Pickering. I think that the law is that a newly elected judge who is previously in PERS is rolled over into PERS, and then it says until March 31st of the year after he was elected, he can either stay in PERS or he can elect JRS. And the law is crystal clear that that election is irrevocable. And there's lots of actuarial reasons why these definitive decisions have to be made and can't be taken back. But, Judge Puccinelli thought that his hand was forced and therefore he could say it doesn't matter or take it back. But the law says there was no legal basis that I could see for Judge Puccinelli to revoke the irrevocability of the JRS election. And so what happens, as you correctly noted from the record, Judge Smith had to make that election. PERS had to tell him that you have to make the election. This is your one and only chance to transfer JRS if you want to, according to Nevada law. He elected under protest, admittedly, but I don't think under protest matters in this case because the law says it's irrevocable. So that liability, over $1 million, is transferred to the JRS fund, and that's where it is now. As we said in our briefs, we think that alone makes this whole case moot because Judge Smith no longer has a PERS retirement account from which to retire.
Now, been indicating it was under protest. Is there anything that he could have done to preserve his interest there?
I don't think so, Your Honor. That's just a function of Nevada law. And
he could have gone to court and asked for it to be interpled or something in a separate account until it was resolved?
No, Your Honor. I think the law is, and maybe that's something that the legislature needs to look at, but the law says that election has to be made no later than March 31st, and that decision is irrevocable. And the papers that Judge Smith signed made that very clear, that you understand this is an irrevocable decision, you can't take it back. And, you know, PERS acts with on an actuarial system where, you know, JRS operates on a slightly different earning system than PERS. So Judge Smith has been earning on a different basis than when he is in PERS while he's been in the JRS. And that may be a shortcoming of the law, I don't know. But there's no basis that I can see in the law, no basis, legal basis offered by Judge Puccinelli or respondent to say there is some way that you can undo the irrevocability of Nevada statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Wicker.
Thank you.
I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal since we asked you quite a few questions. And, Mr. Gardner, I'm going to give you 17 minutes total, give you the extra 2 minutes also at this time. Mr. Gardner, on behalf of Judge Smith.
Good morning, Associate Chief Justice. May the please the court. My name is Charles Gardner, and I represent Respondent Douglas Smith, who is here with us today. We obviously are asking you to affirm the very fine decision of the honorable and unfortunately late Andrew Puccinelli. I couldn't do a better job, so basically all I did in my brief was cite to the record where every one of his, line by line, sentence by sentence, every one of his findings of fact and conclusions of law were supported. It is, and let me quote right now from his brief where he says, this is the page 7 of his opinion. It's at the appellant's appendix, page 52. It would defy logic to assert that the plaintiff was not retired after December 31st, 2008. Now, it would. We also know for a fact here that the reason why January 4th, 2009 was put on a piece of paper that ultimately made its way through Clark County into PERS was that Clark County decided, for reasons we still don't know, that if you want to extend your medical benefits to cover this interim period, at least for the month of January, put down a date in January. If you work a day in January, we know that never happened. It was a fiction. The end of his service was December 31st, 2008.
Ordinarily, wouldn't you, if that's the end of your service, then you would go and you would get COBRA coverage for your insurance benefits ordinarily until you have a new service date, wouldn't you?
I cannot explain why Clark County did this.
So it wasn't an election by Judge Smith to do that then?
It was Clark County. You know what? Clark County could, in fact, put together its own little package for these rare circumstances like this where there might be a couple of months in between insurance policies, and we'll sell you this for a couple of months.
Well, they have that. Isn't that COBRA?
Well, they, believe me, Clark County likely could have done that. But the fact that is relevant to this case is that they told Judge Smith, put down a date in January so that we can extend the benefits. This is the first time that someone has mentioned COBRA to me, and I can understand completely that that would have been a better solution for Clark County to make. But in fact, that January date was a result of Clark County telling Judge Smith, if you want to extend, he didn't tell him COBRA, they didn't tell him anything about COBRA, they said, if you want to extend your medical benefits, just put down a date in January. And that is the genesis of that January date. When Peirce told Judge Smith, for the first time, we are denying your application. That was on January 20th. Judge Smith said, wait a minute. I retired on December 31st, and explained what that January date was all about. Ultimately, we put Clark County's payroll records officer under oath, and she said, yes, December 31st was the last payment from the check of December 19th. Not a penny more went into PERS, proving there was a clear break in service. All PERS had to do when Judge Smith said, and to the board, he asked for a hearing before the board, such as it was, and told the board twice. The second time at the end when they just cut him off and asked for and said, we need a motion and voted against him. He said, my last paycheck was December 19th. I retired as of December 31st. The January date was just something Clark County put in front of me. All PERS had to do was check its own records. At that point, this is 2 weeks later that they told him your application has been denied. Their records showed not another penny more paid into PERS, that his creditable service had ended as of December 31st, 2008. And all they had to do was say to Judge Smith, you know, if we might need another piece of paper from Clark County, why don't you go get it? They finally, you know, when these arguments all have unwound on them, they have continued to try to make one argument after another to deny Judge Smith his application. And, you know, it's this double-dipping concept that's going on here. But let me jump to 286.541.2 for a second to get that completely out of the way. It's a complete red herring. The first contingency there says that your effective date of retirement, basically of your retirement benefits, is the day immediately following the applicant's last day of employment. Now, this is all for determining what date they can start making the payments. There's no other way to read this. If you have the other B, C, and D in, if you have all that paperwork in, then we can start making your payments the next day after your last day of employment. Obviously, those two things aren't the same thing. Your last day of employment is not the same thing as your effective date that you supposedly put your application in. If you have
doesn't
the paperwork,
the statutes under subsection 2, it says that it becomes effective on whichever of the following days is the latter.
Is last, absolutely. Because if you don't have your paperwork in, if you don't have your application in, then that becomes the last day. We obviously can't start making your payments until you apply for them. I mean, that's clear. It's obvious. All this has to do is determine the effective date of actually paying out the PERS payments. It has nothing to do with his job with Clark County. My Medicare retirement effective date is February 1st, 2011. I'm going to be calling them up when I get back and say, sign me up. The effective date is the first date upon which Medicare can start covering my doctor's visits. That's all it means, and that's all it has ever meant. The effective date of your insurance contract, of whatever contract, of any retirement benefits is the date that we can start making the payments out. It has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with this case. It's a complete red herring. You know, when all this stuff started unraveling and we started making these arguments, they just kept making more, kept fishing for more stuff. So now all of a sudden it was like, okay, now you have to retire from PERS. They came up with that argument. But at the end, here we are 2 years later, and in their reply brief, this is the final argument they're making. And Mr. Wicker made it here today. PERS had to accept the information on the termination date provided by Clark County. So Judge Smith needed to have Clark County provide a different termination date. And it is doubtful that Clark County would have done so in light of Judge Smith's acceptance of insurance. Of course, we went a step farther, ultimately. We put the, like I said before, the payroll records officer under oath. It's better than a piece of paper. And she said December 31st is the last date. Would he have been paid a penny more after that? That answer would be no, she said. And that fact is firmly established. I suppose you could remand and say, well, let's get that other piece of paper. I don't see the necessity for that, because we actually have done better than that. And PERS had it in its records the whole time around, this whole time, that not a penny ever more came in. As far as the reestablishing the service goes, and I made this argument in the briefs, Judge Smith is not asking to have PERS service reestablished. If, in fact, PERS made a mistake by rolling the money over, they need to correct it. He doesn't want PERS as his service, as a district clerk. And we don't care where they get the money to cure the problem. But if they want to roll it back from the JRS, that's fine. There are ways of doing it. There is no problem with doing that.
And I guess that's where I'm confused. It says it's irrevocable. So where's the authority for them to do that, to do that?
The choice of having JRS as his service as a district court judge is irrevocable. But all we're asking for is that PERS pay the benefits that they should have paid him when he first applied for them. I mean, they can roll it back if they want to.
Mechanically, how do they do that?
Well, there's no reason why the district judge can't put a constructive trust on it. I mean, the money is in the wrong place. It is, the legal title is held by JRS, but the equitable title should be with PERS for the purpose of paying the benefits. There's nothing nothing impossible about that. In fact, that is just a normal remedy for things like this.
Are those two funds administered separately, the JRS fund and the PERS fund?
They are both administered by the same administration. The PERS administers...
That's a different answer, though, than the question. Do they perform in different investments differently?
I couldn't answer that question. I don't know. But both services are administered by PERS. They have control over both services.
Mr. Gardner, I asked Mr. Wicker about the interpretation of 286.193A and how the board approaches interpreting that statute and whether it's been interpreted too narrowly. My question is, can that statute be relied upon to overturn the statute that makes Judge Smith's election irrevocable?
Well, first of all, I don't think that statute makes it irrevocable. Second of all, if you're going to apply equity in this case, you don't really have to go to 190.
What's the legal authority for setting aside an election that is by statute declared to be irrevocable?
What he elected to do is to have the judicial retirement system as his retirement system as district court judge. And he was put in what's called a Zugzwang. He was going to lose either way he went because of what PERS had done originally. And if there is any equity to be applied, or if it is necessary to apply equity in this case, that would be the easiest place to do it because you have the equitable remedy of a constructive trust. If there's unjust enrichment and the money really should belong here.
I just want you to articulate a statute or a case that allows this court to set aside an election he made that declares by statute it's irrevocable. Do you rely on 286.193A? Do you rely on some case? What is the basis for setting aside an election into JRS that is by statute irrevocable?
I think we have very unique circumstances in this case. And I can't tell you a specific statute or a specific case. It just hasn't happened before.
Then how would you suggest this court arrive at the conclusion that it can set aside an irrevocable election? What would be the construct of the opinion that reaches that result?
The first construct would be that PERS was originally obligated to make to honor his application for his retirement benefits. The second construct would be that the statutory scheme put Douglas Smith into an impossible situation because we didn't know what the outcome would be. He wanted to establish the JRS as his retirement system. The third construct would be that the money was placed in the JRS under those circumstances test and doesn't belong there, to the effect that if PERS is required to make the payments, and again, we don't care where they get the money. They don't really have to take the money back. If the court decides that they are required to make his payments, then I think they would probably be better off to take the money out of the JRS that was transferred over there. But if they transferred it unlawfully, to the extent that they should have made the payment, they should have used it as payment.
Did the court treat his election into JRS as no election at all because he made it under protest? Should it reject the election?
That would be one way to do it, absolutely.
In which case, he wouldn't be in JRS at all for any purpose.
That would be a solution.
But that is not what he asked for in the district court, correct? He asked for PERS benefits plus participation in JRS, so he wants the election into JRS to be effective.
Given the choice, I can guarantee you that he will choose to have his PERS benefits paid to him. Okay.
Did he make that argument in the district court or to PERS?
This has not been made before. That's correct. That question had not been posed. Again, Mr. Wicker has, throughout these proceedings, blamed Judge Smith for not having read all this stuff. He talks in his brief at page 18, lines 6 to 8, if Judge Smith had retired from Clark County when he advised PERS he would and followed the written instructions, Judge Smith should have been able to do what he wanted. Lines 25 to 28 on the same page in their brief, here are the instructions. Quote, the original application for his benefits must be returned to our office on or before your retirement effective date. How can that happen if you are interpreting 286.541.2 to suggest that your retirement effective date is going to be the date of your application? You can't submit your application the day before if that's going to be the last day. I mean, it's just impossible. And there are instructions all the way through here, and all the way through. Your retirement application is no longer your retirement benefits application. They have chopped off the word benefits all over the place. And again, in these instructions, they're just senseless. So I don't know if you could have had Einstein read these instructions and come to the conclusion that the PERS wants you to come to at this stage.
I think your time has expired, Mr. Gardner.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wicker, 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. To answer the statement just made, these instructions are followed on a daily basis by thousands of people, and we don't have the problem that we have here today. The instructions that Mr. Gardner read to you from the service application instructions, they also say, read the pre-retirement guide. It has important information for you for your retirement. The pre-retirement guide goes through the effective date of retirement on page 2, and it talks about exactly what's in the statute. Your retirement is effective the day after your last day of employment or the day your application retirement system, whichever is later. A third possible effective date is a future date you select. It's simply impossible what Mr. Gardner said, that he said it was impossible to turn in your application and then retire at a later date. The fact is, in 286.541, there's four conditions, and the last one of those four conditions to be met is your effective retirement date. Now, 286.541 is very meaningful because it is the only statute in the whole scheme that sets forth how PERS is to calculate when somebody is eligible to retire. We're not talking about a deadline or statute of limitations. We're talking about when are somebody eligible to retire. I will add one other thing. Clark County did not tell Judge Smith that you have to put down a date in January for your separation date. They said in the record, good news, Judge, we found out that if you put If you work one day in January, you can get insurance coverage all of January. So put down January 2nd. Judge Smith put down January 4th in all his papers because he assumed that if he did, maybe he would get insurance for a longer period of time.
Thank you, Mr. Booker.
Thank you.
Court thanks both lawyers, both counsel, for spirited and informative arguments and briefs in this matter. This case will stand submitted. Thank you very much.